Hi, I'm an Allen Ann from Alabama, and my name's Bo Templin. Good morning, y'all. Thank you for getting up so early on a Saturday morning. And I got two or three thank yous that I want to get out of the way here pretty quickly so we can talk some Al-Anon. But first I want to make sure, can all you folks up in the balcony, can you hear okay? If we need to get the sound turned up or anything, well, we will. I say that because my talk is being taped. Now, can you imagine 6 or 7 months down the road when somebody's driving from Atlanta to Birmingham and they're listening to this? I wonder how many people were there. All I can tell you is it's a big balcony. Oh, it's good to be in Macon. It's good to be somewhere where they understand y'all, where we know that y'all is a one-syllable word. Yeah, tell you, that's neat. And it's good to be back at the Georgia State Prepaid Convention again. I want to tell you about that. A special thanks goes with this. 1986, my daughter was the Alateen speaker, and I was the Al-Anon speaker at the Georgia State Prepaid Convention in Savannah, Georgia. And we were 4 years into this way of life. Sissy was a dynamic Alateen speaker who would get up here and talk to you for 3 hours if you would let her, even at 17 years of age. And I was a male Al-Anon then and today. I get you a lot of invitations. But the exciting thing was that was the very first big convention that we had ever been on the program. And the very first time we had an opportunity to share our story at a big convention. And they had a big taper there. He said he was big. I believed him. And he had a big tape of the month club, and he sent my tape and my daughter's tape out on his tape of the month club. And the invitation started coming. And since the Georgia State Prepaid Convention in 1986, in Savannah till today, we have been real, real busy traveling all over the United States and Canada sharing our story, and it started right with you at your convention. How about that? Thank you. Thanks for inviting us back. And thank you for inviting us this weekend. You know, we love to come to the parties. And that's what we look at this as. This is a party. And it was talked about last night right here from this podium by Tom. This weekend is a celebration. A celebration of recovery. And if you're fairly new here, maybe this is your first one or not. I hope that before you leave here, you get that feeling that you have been a part of the party. As you hear my story this morning, you will find out that Shirley and two kids and myself were introduced to this way of life at the party. Labor Day weekend, 1982. We walked into a room on the campus of the University of Alabama in Tuscaloosa for the Tuscaloosa AA Al-Anon anniversary. And we walked into a room where there was 500 of y'all. And you were cleaned up and you'd washed your hair, you'd combed your hair, you had on foo-foo juice, you were running around there hugging each other, and you were laughing and cutting up, and we could tell that it was genuine. We could tell that you were really enjoying life. We didn't know what you had. What we knew was that it was infinitely better than what we had brought to the table. Because, you see, we had just picked Shirley up from a treatment center at noon that day. And this was our introduction to you and into this way of life. And we fell in love with you that night. And we've been here ever since. So thanks for inviting us and allowing us to be a part of the party. This is really special to us. Like Jeff, I've got a couple of things that I want to make to Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you're sitting in this room and you are a member of AA, let me talk to you for just a minute. And what I want to say to you from the very bottom of my heart is thank you to Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you, number one, for being there a little over 19 years ago when my gal reached out her hand. Because, you see, I'd lost her. The bottle had her, and I couldn't do anything about it. And I was driving myself crazy trying to find a way to get her sober and keep her sober. And we surely had that moment of clarity that I believe all recovering people have. And she reached out her hand to AA. You had the hand of AA there for her. And you took her in and you put your arms around her and you loved her back to health. You see, she was dying of a fatal disease that we didn't even know she had. And you didn't ask any questions. And you put your arms around her and you loved her back to health and she didn't have to die. And because of her getting involved in something called AA and me being introduced to something called Al-Anon and two kids being introduced to something called Alateen, we were able to put this family back together. And because of these programs and people like you in rooms like this in our lives, we were able to put this marriage back together. You see, we were 18 and a half years into a marriage that wasn't going to make it to number 19. Because of these programs, this past April, we celebrated number 37. And I think that's awesome for us. I want to thank Alcoholics Anonymous for knowing from the very beginning that this thing called alcoholism is a family disease. And you see, I know that you knew that it's a family disease because I'm one of those Al-Anons that's been raised in the textbook Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm one of those Al-Anons that's been raised by, quote, old-time sponsors, sponsors out of the old school. I'll share with you three or four things today, that ways that you can identify your sponsor and find out if they're out of the old school. One of the ways you can tell if your sponsor's out of the old school is they teach you the history of our fellowships. They make sure that you know our history. And my sponsors, my original sponsors, did this. They taught me the history. And they showed me those two chapters in the textbook Alcoholics Anonymous, chapter 8 and 9, to the wives and the family afterward. And then they taught me about the very first meetings, way back in 1935, before it would even have a name. The very first meetings were family meetings, where the whole family went together and the whole family was included. So I want to thank Alcoholics Anonymous for knowing and for including us from the beginning and for having this 12-step way of life ready for us, this 12-step design for living, ready for us. So that in 1951, when it was time for Al-Anon to be born, and we stepped forward and said, can we have your way of life? And you loved us so much that you put your arms around us and you said, come on in. And here's what we want you to do, Bo. We want you to take these 12 steps. And we want you to learn how to implement these spiritual principles in your life on a daily basis. And we want you to learn how to live happy, joyous, and free. And not be dependent on what another person does or does not do. And for that, I'll be eternally grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I also just mentioned something there. Al-Anon was born in 1951. We are celebrating our 50th birthday this year. Yeah, happy birthday, Al-Anon. 50 years old. When I introduced myself to you a moment ago, I introduced myself as an Al-Anon. You know, I want to stop and I want to say, Jeff, you reckon we can get somebody to do something about what is that light up there?
That's a spotlight, Bo.
You think we could find somebody? That thing is blinding me. Absolutely blinding me. Way back in the back up there, if we could find somebody, I sure would appreciate it.
Somebody up there.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. When I introduced myself to you earlier, I introduced myself as an Al-Anon. I want to talk about that for just a moment. You know, when I got here, Labor Day weekend, 1982, I thought being married to my alcoholic made me an Al-Anon. What I found out over the past 19 years is that being married to Shirley qualifies me for Al-Anon. It does not make me an Al-Anon. And there are several things that I have to do today on a real regular basis to tell you that I'm a member of the Worldwide Fellowship of Al-Anon. And I want to share three or four of those things with you right quick. The first thing I do in order to tell you I'm a member of Al-Anon is I go to a lot of Al-Anon meetings. I suit up, show up, and occupy that chair in Al-Anon meetings. Now, I've got to be honest with you, folks. I've already told you that Shirley and I and Sissy have had the opportunity to travel all over the United States and Canada. I've suited up and showed up and occupied that chair in a lot of things that was called Al-Anon meetings that didn't resemble an Al-Anon meeting. And my job today is to make sure that I can get it back on course if I can. My job is to make sure when I'm in that Al-Anon meeting to try to keep it pure Al-Anon if I can, to make every effort that I can. So I go to a lot of Al-Anon meetings, suiting up and showing up and occupying that chair. Now, I know that this is a program of action. I know that you can't get it just from occupying the chair. But I also believe that it begins with occupying the chair. Let me explain it to you this way. I can take that chair and I can take it out to the back of the lot and I can sit it in the middle of the chicken coop and I can occupy that chair in the middle of that chicken coop every day for 20 years. And guess what? I still won't be a chicken, you see. But I suggest this to you. If I occupy that chair in the middle of that chicken coop every day for 20 years, at the end of that time, I'm going to know a whole lot about chickens. Now, do you hear what I'm saying? It's by suiting up and showing up and occupying that chair and by observing you winners that were there for me when I got here and watching what you're doing, I begin to get an idea of the changes that I'm going to have to make in my life if I want what you have. So, but it begins with suiting up and showing up and occupying that chair. The next thing I do in order to tell you I'm an Al-Anon, and remember, this is just what's worked for both, is I have to have a home group. Now, when I got here Labor Day weekend 1982, I didn't need a home group. When I got here, I didn't need Al-Anon. I got here well, and it took 7 months of occupying space in your meetings for me to find out just how sick I was. But I got here well, and I told you that when I got here. Yeah. You see, that treatment center that my wife went through told her that she had to go to 90 meetings in 90 days, and we did. Now, if you're an Al-Anon, you understand that. But I wasn't going for her. Because, see, I heard something else up there at that treatment center she went through. I heard them when they made the statement, the ones that stay sober are the ones that go to AA. I heard that. And in an instant, my job in life changed. Yeah. Because, you see, she had the problem. And if she went to AA, then she didn't drink, then we'd be okay. So my new job in life now was to make sure she got to AA. And so we're going to these 90 meetings in 90 days, and I learned something about you AAs during this period. I learned you got tunnel vision about two or three things. Real serious tunnel vision about a couple of things. One of the things you're absolutely locked in with tunnel vision about is something called closed meetings. Because the night came that we showed up there at Bessemer, which was to become our home group down the road. And we walked in, and the AAs met me at the door and said, "Bo, this is a closed meeting tonight. And it's for alcoholics only, and you will not be allowed to stay in this meeting." And I said, "But you don't understand." Because, you see, Shirley and I were going to those 90 meetings in 90 days, and we were sitting right down there on the front row. And when that speaker said something that was important, I popped her with that elbow. Made sure she heard it. And I was listening real close because, see, she's still in a fog. Yeah, and I knew there'd be questions when we got home, and I had to be able to answer those questions. And now you're telling me I can't come in there with her. I said, "Don't you understand? I said, "No, Bo, you don't understand. You need to turn her over to us. And they're not aware in that other room that you've been needing to go to anyhow. And you not so gently directed me to my Al-Anon room. And I walked over there that night, and I walked up there to the door of what 7 months later was to become my home group. And I was still in the ism then. I was still sponsoring myself. So when I got to the door, it was 2 minutes to eight. See, once I got old-time sponsors, I found out I have to show up at least 30 minutes early and be prepared to stay till it's over. Well, I still sponsor myself, so I didn't show up 30 minutes early. It's 2 minutes to eight. And I stopped there at the door, and I took a quick head count. There's 23 women and one other guy. And I hustled down there and got a seat by him. Meeting was over, said the Lord's Prayer, and turned around and introduced myself to him. I said, boy, sure I'm glad there's one other guy here. He started laughing. He said, I'm moving to Phoenix City in the morning. He said, it's my last meeting here, Bo. I'm turning these women over to you. And that wasn't nothing but God taking care of me, you see, because it's taken all 23 of them gals from me. And if Kirby had hung around and had a problem, I don't know what we'd have done with it. So he went on down to Phoenix City, and I began to, you know, I told those gals. And I looked at them and I said, I don't belong here. I don't need this. I said, my wife's got the problem and she's out there in that other room. And the only reason I'm in here is because it's a closed meeting out there. And they told me I couldn't stay out there. I had to come here. I said, there's nothing wrong with me, you understand. I'm just here to make sure she's out there. That's my job. And you know what those gals did? They just smiled. And they began to very gently pull me into this thing. And they began to use hooks that I didn't even know existed. And what they were doing is they were just keeping me there until my miracle happened. Yeah. First hook they used on me was laughter. And I remember the laughter in those early meetings. I hope we never lose the laughter. I needed that laughter. There hadn't been a lot of laughter in my life. And the room was full of laughter. That first meeting that night, it was a speaker meeting. And we had one of our seasoned veterans. They won't allow me to call them old-timers anymore. I'm calling them seasoned veterans. And one of our seasoned veterans was sharing her story that night. So she walked up to the front of the room, and she said, hi, my name's Doris, and it's been 14 years since I had to plan a murder. Yeah. And the whole room erupted in laughter. Everybody except me. I shook my head and very quietly to myself, I said, no, I wouldn't have said that. I would have never admitted that, not out loud. But I just like some of you that are shaking your head, I've been planning that murder too. Yeah. Yeah, I was going to kill her and tell God she died. But Doris's story was full of laughter. And before that meeting was over that night, I realized there wasn't anybody laughing at her. They was laughing with her. And I loved that laughter. The next hook that they began to use was something called hugs. Now, we're a hugging group. I know y'all hug over here, too. I know. And I love the hugs. Hey, we hug you when you get there. We hug you when you leave. And sometimes in the middle of a meeting, if you're in pain and you need a hug, you get one. That's okay. It's all right. But here's what they did with me over there. You see, they knew that I didn't want to be there because I told them. Remember? I told them. So they took a chair and they set it right inside the door of the meeting room. And they said, Bo, we know you don't want to be here, so this is your chair. And this is as far in this room as you have to come. And when nights you're here, nobody will be able to occupy this chair but you. And they did it. This is a true story. And nobody could occupy that chair but me. But what they didn't tell me was they was assigning one of them gals to me on a monthly basis. Now, they won't admit it till today, but I know it was true. And she had a job to do, and I'm going to tell you what her job was, and it rotated on a monthly basis. What would happen is, at my home group we close our meetings by holding hands and saying the Lord's Prayer. Now, I'm sponsored by old-timers, so my old-timers have taught me that the Lord's Prayer ends with the word Amen. So consequently, in my home group, we don't say anything after the word Amen. When we say we're going to close with the Lord's Prayer, when we say Amen, the meeting is over. So we would stand to close the meeting, and we'd hold hands, and we'd say the Lord's Prayer, and I'd drop and turn for the door. I'm right there by the door. And there she'd be between me and the door. You see, her job was, while we had our eyes closed, saying the Lord's Prayer, was to drop out of the circle, come around and get between me and the door. And her job was to give me that going home hug. And of course, when she gave me that going home hug, she whispered those words in my ear. You keep coming back, Bo, because we need you. Well, if you needed me. I was going to be bringing her anyhow. And so I made a commitment that I would keep coming back to your meetings, you see. And it kept me coming back till the miracle happened. Now the last hook that they began to use, and they started day one and they're still using it today, is a hook called unconditional love. And I got real concerned a couple of years ago about this thing called unconditional love. You see, I knew that I was an absolute professional at receiving unconditional love. I can just sop up all that unconditional love that you can put on me. What I became concerned about is, am I doing a good enough job in giving unconditional love? And I became real concerned about that. And so I set out to try to find out everything more about unconditional love with this old thought process that the more I know about it, the better I'll be at it. Okay? And I began to try to read about it, and I began to ask questions about it, and I began to try to gain a better understanding about unconditional love. And I got my answer this April of this year, in San Diego, California, at one of these deals. And I'm sitting there on Friday night listening to the AA speaker on Friday night, and he's standing up there at the podium, and he starts talking about his relationship with God. And I'm telling you, this man has a relationship with God. And he began to share about that relationship with God. And he began to talk about how he worked real hard to stay in tune with God so that God could work through him and he could be a channel of God's love. And he said, when I'm in tune with God, he said, I'm convinced that God can love you through me. And he said, when you're in tune with God, he said, I know beyond a shadow of a fact that God loves me through you. And the light bulb went on. I said, God, boy, you've been working all this time trying to become a professional in unconditional love, and you never will be. What you need to be work on is your relationship with God. Because God's the true master of unconditional love. And keep your relationship with God so that God can use you as a tool. And he can love through you. That's unconditional love for me today. And that's what those people in my home group did from the beginning. And they're still doing today. The next thing I'd share with you that I do in order to tell you I'm an Al-Anon is I'm sponsored. I'm sponsored. And when it was time for me to get a sponsor there in Al-Anon, in Bessemer, there were no males. So I asked a lady to be my sponsor. And there's some folks sitting in this room this morning that know Fran. And know, well, Linda knows Fran. And she knows what a gem God put in my life. Fran's old enough to be my mother. Sometimes she treats me like her son. She's a retired school principal. there's a discipline inside to her that exists that I didn't know exists till I asked her to be my sponsor. Fran came in Al-Anon in 1961. She's raised in service. She's a past delegate. She believes in service, and she has raised me in service. And the night that if Fran was here today, she would tell you that the night I asked her to be my sponsor, she said she had a temporary lapse of sanity and agreed. But she put a condition on it, you see. She said, Bo, I'll be glad to sponsor you, but I'll sponsor you the only way I know how. And I said, what's that? She said, in the steps. That's the way I was sponsored. That's the way I will sponsor you. And if you're ready tonight to make a conscious commitment to me that you want to take these 12 spiritual principles and implement them in your life on a daily basis, then I'm ready to take you by the hand and walk with you. And that was 7 months into this way of life. And she still sponsors me today by example. She's moved away, and we don't have the close contact that we used to have. But we still have. She's still, even though she's past delegate, she's still going to area assembly. She's still involved in service. And she sponsors me by example. About 90 days into this, we knew I needed to talk to a man, so she sent me out in the AA room to get a man to talk to. And I happened to pick the one that she'd been married to forever at that time. And he's a past delegate in AA. Believes in service, raised in service, and has pushed me in service. So you see, God knew just how sick I was, and He gave me the best of both programs, the best of Al-Anon and the best of AA at my disposal. Not only do I sponsor, am I sponsored, I sponsor people today. And boy, if that's not a joy. I'm telling you, that is an absolute continuing, growing experience. Some of these guys come along and they just become part of your life. You know, they just become part of your life. And every once in a while you see one that jumps up and does good. And you have to be real careful to not try to take credit for that. You know, that's okay. That's all right. That's another story. The last thing I do, and I ought to tell you I'm an Al-Anon, is I take those 12 simple steps we read this morning. 12 simple steps for a very complicated person. And to the best of my ability, I incorporate them in my life on a daily basis. Getting up each morning, getting in that shower, having that talk with God, inviting God into my life, and asking Him to direct my life on a daily basis. And then my job is to go out there and put one foot in front of the other and be the best Bo I can be today. And some days I do real good at that. Real good. Especially when I'm at things like this. Surrounded by y'all. This is the easy place to do it, isn't it? Where's the tough place? It's out there, isn't it? I don't know about y'all, but it's tough for me on the interstate. Yeah. I can slip right back real quick on the interstate. What I know today is I'm not ever going to be perfect at this, and it really maybe is not even that important how good I do or don't do on a daily basis. The important thing is, am I out there on the firing line? And am I suiting up, showing up, and saying, come on, God, it's me and you, and let's go. Let's go. And these are the things I do in order to tell you today that I am a member of Al-Anon. Let me tell you a little bit about me and about how I got here, because I want to get to what's going on today. I wanted to tell you a little bit about me. I go back and start with this simple statement. I was born at a very early age. Now, it's necessary that I go back there because you people over here in Macon are going to understand this. I was born not too far out of Birmingham, Alabama, over there in the middle of something called a Bible Belt. Southern Baptist Bible Belt. And I was born into a very strict, very religious Southern Baptist home. Now, I don't know how spiritual we were, but let me tell you, we was religious. Yeah. Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night, we was in that Southern Baptist church out there in Hueytown. And what's important about this time in my life, because I was involved in this church up until my late teens. And what's important is that it was there in that Southern Baptist church in Hueytown that I formed the concept of God that I brought into adulthood that caused me some problems. Now, let me set the church free. It was not their fault. The church taught me that God is loving and that God is forgiving. But for some reason, the concept I brought into adulthood was God's going to get you. And I had God sitting up there in that great white throne, and he had that scoreboard, and he was keeping tabs on Bo. And anytime Bo did something wrong, there was a big X, and there was a punishment. There was a price to be paid. And this was my concept of God, and this was my relationship with God when I found the doors of Al-Anon. I had a very judging and a very punishing God that stayed real busy watching Bo and keeping tabs on Bo. Now, being raised in this religious home, I wasn't around any drinking. In my mid-teens, I met Shirley, and we started dating. She will tell you in the morning, she comes from that totally different background. She comes from that broken alcoholic home. But here's the important thing is that she didn't drink either. I didn't drink because I'd never been exposed to it. She didn't drink because she had been exposed to it. And she had made that vow, I'll never let alcohol do to me. And so I won't drink. So we met, and neither one of us drank. We dated for 5 years. No drinking. Finally realized that we could get along, and we set the date and got married, and we set out on this great American dream. We thought we knew everything there was to know about life. We were just two kids, madly in love, ready to tackle the world. And here's what we knew about life. We knew that successful people worked hard, made lots of money, and bought lots of nice stuff. And the more stuff you had, the more successful you were deemed to be. And so we set out chasing the dollar, the great American dream, to buy the stuff. And we saved up, and it didn't take us but a year, and we had that down payment on that first home out there in that suburb in Hueytown. You know the one I'm talking about, the one with a little bitty front yard and a real big backyard, chain link for the kids and the dogs. Just everything's ready. So we're a year into our marriage, and we buy that home. 3.5 years after we were married, along comes the most beautiful, blonde-headed, blue-eyed baby boy that a daddy could ever want, just as precious as he could be, and Mike became a part of the great American dream. 17 months later, along comes Sissy, brown-eyed, just as beautiful and healthy as she could be, and Sissy becomes a part of the great American dream, and we stop and take stock. We got two kids, and we got two cars, and we got two jobs, and we got a house, and everything we got is mortgaged to the hilt. And we're happy chasing that dollar. Chasing that dollar. Had to have the two jobs, so Shirley went back to work. And she was invited to join a sorority there in Bessemer. And she did. And it was at one of these sorority parties one Saturday night down on the Warrior River, not too far out of Hueytown, late in the summer, and it's hot. And it's humid, just like it is in Macon. But there's a gentle breeze blowing across there, off that river. And they got the lights down low, and the music is soft. And the moon's reflecting off of that river, and the mood is just perfect. And I hand my wife the first drink of alcohol she's to ever have. I say, here, honey, drink this. And it wasn't but a couple of years later, down the road, she was right up in my face, and she was shaking her fist, and she was saying things like, Bo, if you had never given me that drink, I wouldn't be the way I am today. Well, you see, I didn't know anything about alcoholism. We didn't know anything about alcoholism. What I knew was that our relationship was changing, not for the better. I knew our family life was changing, and it was getting worse. And I knew our financial situation was changing, and it sure wasn't getting any better. And I could trace the troubles back to about the time the drinking started. And so what I did was I agreed with Shirley, and I relieved her of any responsibility for anything that happened as a result of the drinking. And I took on a load of guilt that was to grow heavier and heavier and heavier as long as the drinking continued. Now, I could stand up here the rest of the day and share with you war stories about our trip through active alcoholism. And I wish we had time to do that, but, you know, maybe we need to do that around the hospitality tables. That's what I like about hospitality rooms. You see, we're in here today, this morning, and there's one story being told. Go with me After I get through and we go to the hospitality rooms and look around, you'll see 500 glorious being told. And as Tom said last night, that's what we are. We're a group of storytellers, aren't we? We share with each other through our stories. But anyhow, I could share war stories with you, but I've learned something about war stories over the years. And what I've learned is that my war stories and your war stories are the same. All the times are different, and the places are different, and the names are different. But you get all that out of the way, you know what's the same? The pain. That's what war stories are about. They're about pain. And we pretty much hurt just a lot. Let me share with you two or three of the pains that I experienced on our trip through active alcoholism. The first pain I share with you is a pain called guilt that I've already talked to you about, that was to grow heavier and heavier until I found the doors of Al-Anon. The next pain I share with you is a pain called anger. I don't know about you, but let me tell you about me. On a good day, I got up angry and went to bed angry. On a bad day, I got up angry and went to bed in a blind, running rage. And I hadn't been raised that way, and I knew that that wasn't the way life was supposed to be lived. But you see, I couldn't find a way out. And everything seemed to be a legitimate cause of anger in my life at that time. The next pain I share with you is a pain called resentment. And I didn't even know what a resentment was until I got here and you taught me. But as I look back, I realize I was living my life full of resentment. Because you see, the time had now come that if you lived up the street from me and I saw you and your family out in the yard doing something together, maybe just cutting the grass or washing the car, or maybe you were cooking out together, if I saw y'all doing something together, I resented you. Because alcoholism had robbed us of that, and we didn't do things together anymore. If I saw you and your family get in your car and come by my house going somewhere together, I resented you. Because alcoholism had taken that away, and we didn't go places together anymore. And of course, when you came by my house, if your car was nicer than mine, I resented you. Because you see, alcoholism had taken the nice things. We didn't have them anymore. And the biggest resentment of all, I resented God. Because you see, God was continuing to punish me because I had given Shirley the first drink and set the whole thing in motion. And he was continuing to punish me through her drinking. And I'm an old Baptist, and I didn't never, you know, I never stopped praying, but boy, they changed. And my prayers had become demands. How much more of this, God? How much more of this you going to put on me, God? How much am I going to have to take? What kind of God are you that would continue to punish me this way? And of course, you know, I wasn't getting any answers to those kind of demands. But once again, I tell you, that was my relationship with God when I got here. The next pain I share with you is a pain of called loneliness and isolation. And I believe the alcoholics, when they talk to me about their disease being a disease of loneliness and isolation, I believe that. What I want them to know is they haven't got a corner on the market. I know about loneliness and isolation too, and it has very little to do with how many people are in the room. Some of the loneliest times of my life have been in crowded rooms, surrounded by friends. You know, I would be somewhere at some kind of a gathering, at some kind of a deal, and I would be sitting there, and I would be looking at my friends sitting around me, and they would be laughing and cutting up, and their laughter would be real. And you could tell that they were having a good time, and they were enjoying themselves. And I'm having to sit there with that old, you remember that old smile we used to have? The one that hurt your teeth? You know, you had to grind your teeth together. I'm okay, thank you. And I'm sitting there grinding my teeth, and in my mind I'm saying, how can you be so happy? How can you be enjoying life so much? And I would want to cry out to you and say, I got a drunk wife at home and I can't sober her up. I can't be happy like you. But you see, I couldn't get the words out because the red flag went up. see, I'm a Southern dad, and I'm the head of the family. And you don't tell anybody that you've got a problem that you can't fix. Because, you see, if you admit that you've got a problem you can't fix, that other pain that's consuming me comes out, and that's a pain called failure. I could fix the things that happened as a result of it, but I couldn't fix her. This is the way I was living my life in July of 1982. Me, two kids who were teenagers by now. Mike was 15, Sissy was 13. Me and Shirley and two teenagers. Living out there in that house, four individuals living four separate lives under one roof. A family completely torn apart, completely ravaged by a disease that we didn't even know we had. And it's late July, and the kids and I are going to a softball game, and once again, Shirley's not going. She didn't want to go with us. We really didn't want her to go. You see, she needed to stay home because she was a home drinker. And we'd be gone 4 or 5 hours, and she would be able to drink without us looking over her shoulder. And she wouldn't have to hide anything from us. And so Sissy and I are already in the car. We're waiting on Mike. He was running a minute or two behind. Mike came to the door. I saw him there, and he stopped, and he talked with his mom for a minute. Then he came and got in the car. And I have Shirley's permission. She'll talk more about this tomorrow morning to share with you briefly about that conversation that Mike had before he came to the car. What happened was he stopped there at the door and he looked at his mom and he said, "Mom, when we get home tonight, you're going to be passed out on the floor, passed out in bed. Where are you going to be passed out tonight?" And Shirley raised her head to slap her son's teeth out. How dare him? How dare him not respect his parent any more than that? And as she raised her hand to do harm to her son, the scene flashed through her mind of the last time that her drunken dad had whipped her with the belt buckle into the belt. And she had screamed out at him and she had said, "Dad, if God ever allows me to have children, I'll never lay a hand on them." Yet here she was about to strike her son and slap his teeth out if she could, and she couldn't deny that drinking had something to do with it till she had a drink in this hand. And Mike didn't wait for the answer, and the slap didn't have to happen. And he came on and he got in the car and we went to the ball game. Mike never told me that night about what was said and what happened. He just got in the car and said, "Dad, let's go." We got home from that ball game that night and I knew something was different because, you see, when we pulled in the driveway, the front door was open. It wasn't locked. And the lights were on, and Shirley was sitting in there waiting on us, and she wasn't passed out. She had been drinking, but she wasn't drunk. And she met me at the door, and she said, "Bo, I can't go on living this way. I've got to do something about my drinking, and I've called a treatment center, and I'm going into treatment." And I reacted just like I know I was supposed to, with all the sarcasm I could muster. I was raised up, you know, and I said, "This is number 1,382. What's different this time?" But I told her I didn't believe her, and I went to bed. And it was the next day when this treatment center called me for insurance information that I even believed. But you see, God was directing our lives right then. God directed us to a treatment center about 40 miles north of Birmingham that believes wholeheartedly in treating this thing as a family disease, believes wholeheartedly in the 12-step programs of AA, Al-Anon, and Alateen. And there was treatment centers in our area at that time that didn't treat it that way, and we didn't know the difference. God sent us right where we needed to be for just a short period of time where we could come out of there and turn the corner into your arms, where we've been ever since. Wish you could have seen us that day taking her off to treatment. Like I say, it was late July. It was hot. I had a pickup truck. Kids put two lawn chairs in the back of the pickup. Had them a cooler of Pepsi and a big blaster radio back there. Me and Shirley up front, off to treatment we go. You'd have thought we was headed to the beach. We get up there to that place, and I get real busy checking her in, and the kids get real busy checking that place out. Get all the business done, we're ready to leave, and this counselor says, now, we have a thing up here called Family Week. And the kids are 15 and 13, so we're going to want both kids to come up here with you, Bo, and move in and live up here for 5 days and be a part of Family Week. And I'll send you a letter when you'll get it in about a week that'll tell you more about it and when it's going to be and everything. And he dismissed us. And on the way home, the kids are talking to me. I said, Dad, we don't know about this thing called Family Week. We don't want to go up there and spend a week. So while you was checking her in, we checked that place out. And Cece spoke up and said, yeah, they don't have a swimming pool. And then Mike says, yeah, and Deb, we snuck a look in one of the rooms. Said, they don't have any TVs in the room. And then Cece, you know, she knew she'd get me with this. She said, and we went around to the kitchen, Dad, and all they have up here is decaffeinated coffee. Said, they don't, all they got is fruit juice. They don't even have cocoa. I looked at him, I said, kid, settle down. We're not going to Family Week. Well, y'all don't understand about business. Let me explain to you. We got real good insurance. And it'll pay for us to go up there. And that guy's job was to try to sell us on that. I said, that's just being nice to him. There's nothing wrong with us. We're not going up there. And about a week later, I get the letter. And there's a statement in that letter that just jumps off the page at me. And the statement was, we want you and the kids to come up here, spend 5 days, and learn how to live with your alcoholic. Now, that's what the statement said. Now, that's not what registered. I called the kids in. I showed them the letter, read them that statement. I said, I think we better go. Because I said, kids, we already know there's certain things that she can't drink. There's probably foods that she don't need to eat. You know, anything with vinegar in it. There's certainly going to be TV programs that she's not allowed to watch. And of course they're going to school us in what magazines we can have in the home, those without the liquor ads. In other words, kids, what they're going to do is they're going to teach us how to keep her sober, so we better go. So off to Family Week we went. They call it Family Week, I call it Hell Week. So that's what it was. Two or three things right quick I want to tell you about Hell Week. Number one, Monday afternoon, very first thing, right out of the deep. They get 18 of us in a room together. There's 18 people up there, me and Mike and Sissy, and then 15 people representing other patients. We didn't know them, they didn't know us. They get all 18 of us in the room. And they began to talk to us. And they began to give us an education about the disease of alcoholism. And they're telling me things like, Bo, your wife is sick. She has a disease, and that disease is called alcoholism. And since it is a disease, Bo, there's three C's that you need to learn. The three C's are that you didn't cause it, you can't control it, and you can't cure it. Well, you see, they even told me then that I was going to learn more about that in Al-Anon. That these were the three C's that I would learn in Al-Anon. You see, I needed to hear that. Because you know what I took up there with me? I took that load of guilt. And when they began to teach me about the disease and began to show me that I didn't cause it, then I could start the process that I finished in Al-Anon of shedding that load of guilt. Because you see, what I've learned is that since it is a disease, then I'm not responsible for her having it. Now, the last 19 years in Al-Anon, what I've been working on, is since I'm not responsible for her having that disease, I no longer need to try to be responsible for her recovery from that disease. And I've been taught in Al-Anon by loving people how to detach with love from my wife and put her in God's lap where she belongs And let her and her recovery be between her and the God of her understanding. And guess what that's done for both? That's freed up untold time and energy for both to work on both. Yeah. The next thing that happened up there is they had a lady come up there and hold an Al-Anon meeting for us. And we went to that Al-Anon meeting that night, and I've got vivid memories of that Al-Anon meeting. We were required to go. All 18 of us were there. And I don't know what she did with the other 17 people in that room. Because my memory is, and I can still see her beautiful face, and she pointed her finger and she said, "Bo." And she talked directly to me. You see, God sent her there for me. And she came out of the old school. What do you mean out of the old school? I mean, she didn't water down anything. And she didn't sugarcoat anything. She came in there and she brought me a message of recovery and a message of hope. And she came in there and she didn't give me any options. You see, old timers don't give options. What she brought me was good, orderly direction. And that's what I needed in my life that night. Options had gotten me there. And I didn't need any more options. I needed good, orderly direction. And God sent her there for me with that good, orderly direction. Right out of the old school. She looked at me and she said, "Bo, if your wife's going to stay sober when she gets out of here, she's going to go to AA. Period." She said, "Now, if you want to regain your sanity and begin to experience any serenity, you're going to go to Al-Anon. Period." She didn't say, "I hope you do," or "I'm here to encourage you to." She didn't even use the infamous, "Why don't you try 6 meetings?" No, she just pointed her finger and she said, "Big boy, if you want what we got, then this is where you'll go because this is where it is." And right before the meeting closed, she said, "And by the way, if you're going to be any kind of daddy at all, you're going to make sure those kids are introduced to Alateen." So the kids and I dodged bullets for the rest of the week, got out of hell week, waited on Shirley. Picked her up on Saturday 12 noon of Labor Day weekend, 1982, with instructions to go straight to the Best Moray A Group, where we would meet up with a group of people, and we were going to become part of something called a convoy. And we were going to convoy 50 miles down the road to Tuscaloosa to their AA Al-Anon anniversary. Now, I know some of the people sitting in this room, and I know that you used to convoy to meetings. And we don't do that anymore, and I miss that. I miss that meeting on the way to the meeting and that meeting on the way home from the meeting. I wish you could have seen us that Saturday. It's just like it is here in Macon, Labor Day weekend. It's hot. Now, the story grows, you know, as we go. I'm up to now where there's about 80 cars in that convoy. I wish you could have seen them. They were pickup trucks. They were Suburbans. They were station wagons. They were taxi cabs. They were two-doors. They were four-doors. They were sports cars. It was everything. Every one of them was a drunk vehicle. There wasn't a straight piece of sheet metal nowhere. And they didn't want them to have air conditioner at work. And we had 100 cars full of people to put in 80 cars. And we're packing them in, and here we go down the road to Tuscaloosa for our introduction to you and for our beginning of this way of life. What a deal. What a deal. We got home at night. Shirley will tell you more about that anniversary in the morning. We got home at night, Shirley's first night home in 38 nights. And me and her and 2 kids sat in the living room of the den floor. With a gallon of milk and a 2-pound bag of chocolate chip cookies. And we sat there and we watched the sun come up. Because you see, we didn't have the curtains pulled anymore. And the front door was open. And we wasn't trying to keep y'all out. And we talked about this thing that we'd heard about. We talked about family recovery. And we made that commitment as a family to give this thing our best shot. That commitment so far has led us to being right here with you today. What a trip it's been. What a trip. We asked the kids to go to 4 Alateen meetings, one a week for 4 weeks, and then we'd talk with them. Mike went to his 4 meetings, sat down, looked at his mom, said, "It ain't for me." 15 years old, he had other things to do. He said, "Oh, if y'all are going to a convention on the beach, I'll go." He said, "But I just don't need to go to those meetings every Tuesday night and sit in there and do all that talking. Mom, I love you being sober, and I'll be there when you get them a day." Sissy said, "I found my home. I love it, and you're not going to drag me away from it." She is 13 years old. And I need to stop right here and thank Alateen for saving my daughter's life. Because you see, it was 2 years later that she was able to tell us that she was contemplating suicide when her mom went into treatment. And the best me and Shirley could do was we missed it. And she went into Alateen and she found the hope that she needed, and she didn't have to do that. And Alateen raised my daughter and made her the lady that she is today. She stayed in Alateen till she was 20 and she came into Illinois. She's 32 years old today with 19 years of Alateen in Illinois. Let me tell you what she does every Tuesday night now. She drives 25 miles back to Bessemer and she sponsors that Alateen group that she's raised in. Kind of daughter I got. Thank you, Alateen. So we're off and running on this thing. And I'm floundering around. And for 7 months, I occupied space in your rooms. Because you see, my wife wasn't drinking and we was going to be okay. And 7 months into this, I was about as miserable as I had ever been. And I looked at my wife and I said, "You're laughing and you're cutting up and you're enjoying life and I'm miserable. What's wrong? What's..." And she told me about her sponsor and she told me about her book and she told me about her new relationship with God. And she said, "Bo, these things are available to you." And I went back to Al-Anon the next night and I asked Fran to be my sponsor. And I've already told you about that. She agreed with that condition. And what happened was we began to get involved in the spiritual journey. And we began to get involved in implementing these spiritual principles in my life. Wasn't too long till I thought it was time to do an inventory, and I started trying to do that, and I couldn't get it done. I go to Jim and Fran, and I said, "You know, I'm having trouble doing this inventory." Fran says, "Bo, if you're trying to do the 4-step, you've got to be in trouble." "So what do you mean?" She said, "You can't do the 4-step because you're not through with the 3rd step. She said, "You still got a God that's sitting up there judging you and punishing you, and you're going to have to do something about your concept of God before you can make much more progress." And that's when my AA mentor, Jim, reached out and took me by the hand and took me into his study. And we sat out at his desk, and he got out the textbook Alcoholics Anonymous. And he opened up that book to the chapter to the agnostic, and he took me into that chapter. And it was right there in the chapter to the agnostic in the textbook Alcoholics Anonymous that I found the God that I have today. And it's no longer a God that judges and punishes. I have a God today of infinite power and of infinite love. Never-ending power and never-ending love available to me 24 hours a day. And I keep God real busy today, loving me and forgiving me. That way he doesn't have time to judge me, even should he want to. And so I've got this new concept of God. And so I said, "Well, now I'm off and running." But I wasn't, you see. I was running, yeah. But I continued to run from God. Because you see, in that Southern Baptist church, if you turned it over to God, you had to become a Sunday school teacher or a song director or a missionary. And I was running from God because I was afraid of what God had for me to do. And God just let me get just as miserable as I had to get. And I remember that Wednesday morning, Ben and I talked about it before I came up here this morning. And I remember that Wednesday morning that I got up and I went in the kitchen and I told Shirley, I said, I don't want to go to work today. She said, well, why don't you take a day off? I said, I don't want to stay home. I said, I am so miserable in my own skin. I just don't like me. And I finally decided I'd go to work. I could be miserable there and get paid for it. And I started trying to get to work that morning in Bessemer. And I made it halfway to work, and I pulled my truck over, and I sat there on the side of the road, and I beat on the steering wheel. And it was about 8:05 that Wednesday morning, and I hollered at God. And what I hollered was, God, I don't know what I've got that you can use. And God, I don't know where we're going to have to go to use it. And God, I don't know what we're going to have to get involved in to make it work. But whatever I've got and wherever I've got to go and whatever I've got to do, God, let's do it. Because, God, I can't fight you anymore. And I surrendered. I surrendered. As I look back, I realize what I did that morning was I fired Bo as the general manager of Bo's life. And I looked and I hired the best general manager that was available. And that's God. And my biggest job since that morning to right here today has been to keep Bo fired and God hired. And as long as I can keep it in that sequence, this thing seems to go okay. And then spiritual growth began to really come, and good things begin to come in our lives, and we begin to put this family really begin to come back together. And then we've had to walk through a couple of tragedies that I want to share with you. But I want to share these with you not from the point of the tragedy. I want to share with you so I can share your part that you played in it and how important you have been in our recovery process and how important you are today in our recovery process. We're 5.5 years into this thing and we're growing spiritually, we're growing as a family. And then we opened the door on a Tuesday night at midnight, look at 3 policemen that tell us that Mike, our 20-year-old son, has been killed by a drunk driver. And we went right back to square one. But here's what happened, folks. We had you. We had you. Within 45 minutes of us getting the message of Mike's death, you were in our home. Yeah. AA and Al-Anon was in our home. Now, the rest of the family came, and they got tired and had to go home. The church came, brought the fried chicken, and they left. AA and Al-Anon came and did something different. You came and you stayed. You stayed. And when you came in the door, you looked at us and you said, we don't have the answers. We didn't come here to explain this. We don't understand this any more than you. We came because we know you're in pain. We know you're hurting. And we're here because we got big hearts and we got open arms and we got soft shoulders. And we want you to allow us to put our arms around you and love you through this. And then you began to make decisions for us, and you made good decisions. Because you see, we were incapable of making decisions. Now, I want to share with you real quickly, it's real important, about the last time I saw Mike alive. He was killed at 9 o'clock on a Tuesday night. Last time I saw him alive was 7 o'clock that morning. He was leaving the house to go to work. 20 years and 6 months old, full of life, enjoyed life. And he came by my chair and tapped me on the shoulder and said, I'm going to work, Dad. Took about 3 steps toward the front door and turned around in the middle of that room and looked me dead in the eye. He said, I love you, Dad. Out the door he went. You see, I'm here today to report to you that the last words that I heard my son speak was, I love you, Dad. And that ain't a bad deal at all. And I'm here to say thank you to people like you in rooms like this because you taught us how to live that way. You gave us that precious gift. We wasn't living that way when we got here. And you taught us how to live that way. Yeah. Charlie's got an uncle that's a deacon in the Southern Baptist Church. Not in where we live, in another area. He heard about Mike, came straight to us. He sat in our living room from Wednesday morning till Saturday. He got ready to go back home. He sat down and talked with me and Shirley, and he said, "I don't know a whole lot about AA and Al-Anon." He said, "But let me tell you two people something." He said, "For goodness sake, y'all stay there. Don't you ever get away from it." He said, "I've been a deacon in the Southern Baptist Church for 25 years. I've sat in your house for the last 4 days, and I felt closer to God than I ever have in my life." He said, "There's a power in what y'all are involved in." He said, "Don't you ever stray away from it." Let me tell you, folks, I'm convinced. I'm convinced that there's a power in our way of life that my simple mind is not capable of comprehending. I'm convinced that there's a power in this room today. And there's a power in this weekend that we're sharing together that none of us will ever be able to fully comprehend. We just got to reach out and tap into it. Take part in it. Yeah. Absolutely powerful, powerful stuff. I have walked. I'm convinced that I have walked to the deepest, darkest valley that a daddy will ever have to walk through. I might have to walk through one just as deep and just as dark should something happen to Sissy. But it won't be any deeper. And it won't be any darker. The good news about that is I've never taken one step of that journey by myself. You see, all the way you've had this hand and God's had this hand. And we've made that walk together. What a deal. That ain't a bad deal for a guy that came here 19 years ago to learn how to keep his wife sober. It ain't a bad deal. And so we begin to walk through that valley, and you begin to hold on to us, and you begin to love us and nurture us back to health. The other thing you need to know is that Friday morning when we went to that funeral home, I was able to walk up to my son's casket, and I was able to say goodbye to him as best you can. But I didn't have to stand there and say, "Son, I wish we had talked about this," or "Son, I wish we had done that." Because of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon and Alateen, it was a done deal with me and my son. We had had those talks, and we were okay. We were all right. And then we began this walk of recovery again, and you begin to hold on to us, and things begin to get better again. And then Sissy falls in love, and her knight in shining armor didn't come in on the great white steed. He came in riding the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And 5 years of good, solid 12-step recovery, and she and Bob get married. And then Bob had had a previous marriage, and he brought two children with him. Shirley and I walked in that Southern Baptist church in Hewittown, same one we got married in. And we walked out that day, and we had acquired a new son-in-law and two precious grandchildren with no diapers to change. Yeah. You think God ain't good to us? I wish you could have seen us. You know, there was a huge crowd there. Most of them was y'all. We started that thing. Shirley will tell you all about it, but we started it with a serenity prayer and we closed it with the Lord's Prayer. And I've still got a resentment today that I still haven't been able to work through. And the resentment is Shirley wouldn't let me pass the basket. So Bob and Sissy get married, and we decide to sell the big house out there in Hewittown and move to the woods. So 4 years ago, we sold the big house, and we found us some land out there in the woods. Bob and Sissy said, "Y'all can't go without us." So we're land barons now. We own 2 acres out there in the middle of the woods. And we went out there and we put a house up on top of the hill for us and a house down at the bottom of the hill for them. And things began to get smooth again, began to smooth out. And then June of 99, Shirley and I are out of town, and we get the message that our daughter has just found out that she has an aneurysm in her brain. And I go completely berserk. We get in the van, we're on the way back home, and I'm hollering at God, and I'm telling him, God, you got my boy now. This ain't right. It just ain't right, God. You got my boy. You see, I don't know about you, but in my mind, you see, when the first thing that I saw when I heard that my daughter had an aneurysm is I saw her laying there in that casket. I go right to the worst, do you? Then I have to work my way back from it. And I had her in it because, you see, I know about aneurysms. I've heard about them. And I know they're fatal, and I know the only treatment for them is brain surgery. And finally, surely, I looked over at my wife. It's raining, and I'm crazy behind that steering wheel, and I looked over at her, and I saw a calmness come over my wife that was absolutely powerful. Powerful. I saw the craziness go out of her. She reached over, and she was to tell me later it was as if she felt a hand on her shoulder. She reached over and she laid her hand on mine. She said, Bo, if you'll pull this van over, I believe I can drive us home. And as she got behind the steering wheel, she began to tell me, she said, I don't know how, I just know that it's going to be okay. And from that moment on, Shirley was okay with it. We got home and I got to my daughter and I looked at my daughter and she said, Dad, I don't know how, but I know that it's going to be okay. And I'm a basket case. And you see, folks, the reason I'm a basket case is, and I couldn't even put my finger on it at the time. It was later, I'll tell you. There was an amend that I needed to make to my daughter. And I knew that I couldn't stand there at that casket and be as comfortable as I had been with mine. Well, my daughter found a brain surgeon in Birmingham that believes in God. She found the only brain surgeon we know of in that area that doesn't think he's God. And she took me up there with her because I was still a basket case. And as we sat in that surgeon's office and talked, he told her, he said, Sissy, I need to ask you a question or two before I can accept you as a patient. She said, I don't accept everybody. And she said, ask me anything, Doc. And he said, okay. And he rolled over and he tapped her on the knee. He was in one of those chairs, you know, the length of the row. He rolled over and he tapped her on the knee and he looked her dead in the eye. He said, honey, tell me about your relationship with God. And she told him about her relationship with God. And he looked at me and he said, Daddy, I think we're okay. And he told her, he said, that Tuesday morning when I operate on you, the last thing that you will know is that with my staff, we will gather around your bed and we'll hold hands and we'll pray. And then we'll put you to sleep. And that's exactly the way. Well, you know the deal. Textbook operation. Operated on her on Tuesday morning, sent her home on Saturday morning. He said, I've never done this before. But you're well. Go home and heal. Get home 2 weeks later. My daughter writes me a little note, wrote me and her mom a note. And I get home from work that day and Shirley hands me my note and I open it up and I look at it. And the note says, Dad, I want to thank you for the God that you have in your life. And Dad, I want to thank you for being strong enough in your belief in your God that you can talk openly with me about God. And that you can share with me about your God and that you make no mistake that there's a God in your life. And she said, I want to thank you for that. You'll never know how important that has been during this time. You see, the amend that I had been trying to figure out how to make was, how do you make an amend for not carrying your child to church as a child and allowing her to have a God as a child? And we didn't do that. And now Sissy had to find her God through Alateen and Al-Anon, which was okay. But I felt like I had robbed her of something. And I didn't know how to make that amend. And I'm sitting here and I'm reading this note. And the craziness goes away. The amend has been made. And I didn't even know it. powerful, powerful God that I have in my life. And I hope it's a powerful, powerful God that you have in your life. I'm running out of time. I've run out of time. I got to shut this thing down. I need to tell you that living problems go on. Our son-in-law, Bob, in July, had to have a kidney removed. And he's had several complications beyond that. But he's okay today. And he's over the hump and he's getting well. And it's been because of prayers from rooms like this full of folks like you. See, we believe in the healing power of prayer. We believe in that. We don't discount doctors. We just believe in prayer too. And so Bob's getting well. And he's back online. I'm 58 years old and I'm unemployed for the first time in my life. And fear of economic insecurity has not left me. But my wife has the best job she's ever had in her life. And my job today is to get up early and make sure she gets to her job. And so you see, I wish I could have told you I figured that out for myself, but I didn't. I heard it from you. I heard it from you. That's how important you are. I hope you have a little bit of an inkling of just how important you are in our lives and what you mean to us. If you do, I'm going to close by making this deal with you. I've never seen the burning bush, and I've never experienced the flash of light and the cool breeze. But my God speaks to me on a real regular basis. And darned if when he speaks to me, darned if it doesn't look and sound a whole lot like you. That's the part you play. So now you know the part that you play, here's the deal. I'm going to keep coming back to rooms like this full of folks just like you. You're part of the deal. I want you to keep coming back. Rooms like this full of folks just like us. Now I've made this deal with some folks in this room. So I know it works. Now, if I keep coming back and you keep coming back, then one day, just maybe one day, somewhere, our paths will cross again as we trudge this road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Thank you.